Hi, everyone. It's Brian Kilmeade here. Are you tired of those uncomfortable dress shirts, especially when they bunch up under a sweater? If so, then you must check out Collars & Co., makers of the Dress Collar Polo. Listen up. These shirts are four-way stretch, buttery soft polos with firm dress collars on them, so they give you the dress shirt look, but extremely comfortable polo feel. You can wear them with anything, under a sweater, with a blazer, or by themselves as an elevated polo. They work for any occasion. These polos are perfect, whether it's in the office, on a golf course, or a night out. Collars & Co. is exploding and have gone viral on social media thanks to the $1 million investment they received on Shark Tank from Mark Cuban and Peter Jones. You don't have to worry about collars that flop down and spread out. They stay firm and sharp all day. It's an amazing array of sweaters, quarter zips, pants, and outerwear. If you're looking for the performance dress shirt or polo that looks great all day, check out collarsandco.com. Use promo code Brian for 15% off of any purchase of $100 or more. That's promo code Brian. But I want to bring in Jennifer Griffin now. Jennifer, welcome back.
Thank you, Brian.
So, Jennifer, if you were inside the meeting between the Prime Minister of Israel and the President of the United States, I sense this is very substantive. What do you think they're just talking about?
Well, I think it's very clear. Let's look at a few things that have happened this morning. First of all, Prime Minister Netanyahu met with Secretary of State Marco Rubio this morning. He signed on to the Board of Peace in Gaza. That's something that Israel has not really wanted to be involved with because they didn't like the members that were being included, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan. Turkey. They had issues with the groups that were involved, and they were worried they were going to get pushed into something in Gaza that they don't want to agree to from a security standpoint. So that is showing that Prime Minister Netanyahu is under some pressure from the U.S. government. He met with Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, who obviously are taking the lead on not only Gaza, but also other significant talks right now. In terms of Iran, I thought it was notable that Vice President J.D. Vance said today, put out a statement today, that if the Iranian people choose to overthrow their government, then that's one thing, but it will be up to the Iranian people. That is definitely the White House taking a step back from regime change talk in terms of Iran. What we do know is that the talks that took place between the Iranian sides that included Witkoff, Jared Kushner, and the head of CENTCOM, they were face-to-face. I was able to report that last week. And they were only discussing the nuclear program. And we also heard from foreign minister as soon as he got back from those talks that Iran, their hardline stance in those talks is that they will continue to have the right to enrich uranium. That's a non-starter for the U.S. and Israel. Israel is here because they also are mostly concerned that the U.S. is not going to deal with the ballistic missile program. That if that's not even part of these negotiations, Israel still feels that they are in the direct line of sight for Iran's ballistic missiles, which have grown tremendously. The stockpiles have grown tremendously since last summer. And that is why I think that Prime Minister Netanyahu is here today meeting with the president.
Here's what General Keane said about that meeting. Cut 16.
The meeting between these two leaders is quite amazing. President Trump's been in power for 13 months, and this is his seventh meeting with Prime Minister Netanyahu. You got to look at what he is. He's really a wartime commander, and President Trump certainly is full throttle in support of this wartime commander, because obviously they're our closest ally in the Middle East, and he is fighting Iran and its proxies, trying to literally destroy the state of Israel. This is what this has been about.
So they're probably going to have a meeting. Number one, were you surprised, Jennifer Griffin, that about 3 weeks ago when the president said to the protesters, "I got you back," Prime Minister Netanyahu came out and basically said, "We're not ready"?
I was not surprised, because most of the U.S. Central Command assets had been pulled out of the Middle East, significant assets like the aircraft carrier, to be sent to Venezuela. They were in the Caribbean. A lot of the air, the missile defense that would protect not only Israel, but also U.S. bases across the Middle East were not in position. There were concerns about the number of interceptors that were pre-positioned. They had blown through a lot of those for the THAAD and other defense missile systems. So what we've seen now in the last month is a massive buildup of forces in the Middle East that would provide protection protection, not only for Israel, but also for U.S. bases, which are very, very vulnerable, particularly to, if you look at Bahrain and along the Gulf side of things, where the U.S. has a number of bases. Those are very vulnerable to not only Iranian missiles, but also their Navy. Their Navy was not disabled last summer, and they have a very significant ability to disrupt the Strait of Hormuz. So what we're seeing is a massive buildup, but we also see a kind of buying of time. And it seems like the president wanted to buy time by positioning the aircraft carrier, by now talking about maybe sending a second aircraft carrier. That would delay things by another 2 weeks. And so I think the president genuinely wants to see if he can make gains in negotiations. I don't think he wants to have to militarily act, but he also has told CENTCOM to be ready. And CENTCOM has told him that they needed a little more time to get everything positioned. Mm-hmm. That buildup is almost complete, I would say, but there are a number of things happening in the region that I think would delay the timing of any sort of strike. So I don't believe there'll be a strike tonight, for instance. First of all, there would never be a strike while the Israeli prime minister is visiting the U.S. Yeah. inside the U.S. He's not going back till Friday. You also still have a very sensitive mission taking place in Syria, where the U.S. military is moving up to 7,000 ISIS prisoners. About half of that, I'm told, has already taken place, moving them to Iraq because of the instability in Syria. There is no way that the U.S. is going to jeopardize troops on the ground and that mission by starting a second front with Iran at this moment in time. So that's not complete. You also have the Olympics going on. And we saw, you know, years ago when, 4 years ago when Putin invaded Ukraine, countries tend not to do big military strikes while the Olympics are going on.
This is Ainsley Earhart. Thank you for joining me for the 52-episode podcast series, The Life of Jesus.
A listening experience that will provide hope, comfort, and understanding of the greatest story ever told. Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Well, that's interesting. So where do you think we would target? And would are there people in Iran, do you think, that we have located that we might be able to work with?
Well, I am quite certain there's been a covert operations down, you know, across Iran going back to the December timeframe. If you listen to Scott Bessent, the Treasury Secretary, he testified to Congress that he believed that one of the he believed that the reason that the protesters came out in December was because of some of the economic the maneuverings of basically crashing the dollar in Iran, making a shortage of dollars. So there was a run on banks, the failure of a bank then put people into the streets. He was basically taking credit for that financial and economic move in December that then saw those tens of thousands of and hundreds of thousands of Iranians take to the streets. I would also point out today, Brian, that this is the anniversary of the revolution, and the regime itself is reporting that there are 23 million Iranians in the street supporting the revolution, supporting the regime. I don't have any confirmation of that, but certainly they have put a lot of pressure on people to come out and show that there's still support for the regime. So the president is in a very, very tricky position in terms of decision making. From a military standpoint, the question the military is asking is what comes next? What comes next? You can take out missile sites, but many of Iran's missile launchers are mobile. They have about 200 mobile missile launchers. Those are very difficult to target in real time. They can certainly take out the stockpiles. They can go back and try to hit some of the nuclear sites, but many of the three sites were basically destroyed. However, there's still this missing more than 900 pounds of highly enriched uranium that's not accounted for. That is going to require probably boots on the ground or inspectors to ever get to that. So these are the they can carry out military strikes, but to what end? And what happens if you target the regime itself and it's overthrown? What comes next? There are people who can take the place of this regime. This is not a small, like, a pinpoint operation where you grab someone like Maduro and suddenly you control the government. You're talking about a Shia Muslim regime that there are layers of people who could still step in even if you took out the top leadership.
Jennifer Griffin, our guest. Jennifer, NATO, our vulnerability to Russia, the Germans are starting to step up, but I'm watching your report with Brett Baer last night. NATO is not ready to push back on the Russians, are they?
Well, it was really interesting. This war game that was carried out by the German newspaper, Die Welt, and had some very senior former NATO officials who were playing role-playing the different response time. What they were looking at was the decision-making by NATO members and whether Germany would send troops into Lithuania if Russia used as a cover a humanitarian operation to move its troops into Kaliningrad, which you cross through Lithuania basically to get to Kaliningrad, which is a Russian territory, that would be a move that Russia could use to basically threaten Europe. But the decision-making time was slowed because of the chaotic nature of 32 NATO members having to decide if this was an Article 2 violation. And they really found that it was too slow and that that Europe and NATO was not prepared to react swiftly enough, particularly if the President of the United States expressed any concern about invoking Article 5 or slowed the process in any way. And that was what really came out of this war game. And it is a wake-up call to Europe. Also, we were also reporting, and this is significant, that Britain has released a defense. The defense industry in Britain only has 8-day supply of ammunition if there were a war in Europe. That is a huge wake-up call and should be a wake-up call for NATO.
So just real quick on Russia and Ukraine, Lavrov came out yesterday and says U.S.-Russian relations are going in the wrong direction, blamed us, the fact that the peace process, he says, has slowed down. Blamed us for the fact that it slowed down. I find that very interesting.
This is the trick that the Russians always pull. And this is the problem with the Iranians and the Russians. They go into open-ended negotiations because they want to buy time. They play games. They are the most frustrating partners to have to try and negotiate with. There is no way that the Russians or the Iranians are going to negotiate an end to either their occupation of a country like Ukraine or the end of their regime. So these negotiations, they need to be very finite. They need to be specific about what and not open-ended, because that is the game that that countries like Russia and Iran play. And right now, it's not clear. I mean, there's no indication that Putin is ready to stop his war in Ukraine.
Even though he's losing about 35,000 soldiers a month.
He's not afraid of that. I mean, that's what we can never understand, that autocratic regimes, there is no depth to the amount of loss that they, go back to World War II, look at how many people Russia lost. We don't understand, and they are recruiting people from Africa, they're recruiting people from North Korea. Yes, it's hard on them. The only thing that's really hard on Russia is to lose their petrodollars. And so the targeting, the best thing that the administration is doing right now is targeting this ghost shadow fleet of oil tankers that are basically helping Iran and Russia avoid sanctions. You tighten that up and you really shut down the economy and the money flowing into Russia. That's the only way to stop this war.
Jennifer, so much going on, and we'll see what happens with Iran. I get the sense the president's going to be taking action. Jennifer Griffin, thanks so much.
Thank you, Brian.